Trust that you all had a great Christmas. First service looked like they hadn't had enough sleep, so they caught up on it during worship. Second service was awake, but they looked like they had too much eggnog. They kind of yawned. And I'm counting on third service today. Okay? If you don't laugh when you're supposed to, I'm going to, tap the microphone and say, let's run that, rewind that again. Yeah, I had a good Christmas, and I got one of those Christmas presents. This tie that I got from my mother-in-law, the strange part about it was normally you take the price tags off of something before you give it to somebody. But in this case, my mother-in-law intentionally left the price tag on it because she said that I wouldn't believe how much she paid for my tie. So I got the tie out and I looked at it and it had an $85 price tag on it. I said, $85? I don't pay $85 for a suit. You can tell, can't you? No, I got rid of all those polyester ones after I got married. My wife said, you can't wear anything that shines. I said to my mother-in-law, $85 for a tie? She said, no. I didn't pay $85 for it. She said, I went into the store, and I told the store manager, that's the tie I want to buy. When it goes on sale, call me, and I'll come back and buy it. He said, lady, it just went on sale. So you can try that technique today in your shopping and see if it works. My son also got some great Christmas presents. I said, you got those presents from God. He said, what Christmas present would you get from God? Well, he got two tickets to the San Antonio Spurs and the Boston Celtics on Friday night, last Friday night. I said, you got those from God because there's no way that I would pay $49 a piece for tickets. But there was a guy who called me up, and he had an extra set of tickets, and he called me the day before Christmas and said, I got to get rid of these tickets. I can't go to this game. Would you like them? And I said, sure. So they went in my son's stocking. So Friday night, Ben and I got in the car. He'd been running a fever for 2 days, but when you get a gift from God, you go. Okay? We got in the car, and we drove for an hour and a half to San Antonio. Circled the Alamo Dome several times being told, no, you can't park in all this empty parking lot around the Alamo Dome unless you've got a permit, which I assume costs a lot more money. So we found a parking lot several blocks away that a guy was willing to let us park in, probably someone else's parking lot that he was collecting $5 a car for, but that's where we parked. We walked back through the wind up to the Alamo Dome, found our way in, got to our seats, sat down. And, I couldn't tell whether I was at a basketball game or a bar. Ever since they started serving alcohol at athletic events, people are more interested in drinking than they are watching the game. And we were sitting on the aisle. And every 2 minutes, there was a beer salesman come by, standing in the aisle, opening cans of beer for all the good old boys. And we couldn't watch the game. Every time David Robinson would make a great dunk, we would have to look up on the screen, see it on the screen. But, through all of that, my son was having a great time. And we sat there together, and I just watched him smile, and I watched him having a good time, and I was thinking to myself the whole time, why in the world would I do this? Why in the world would I drive all the way to San Antonio on the day after Christmas when I could be at home doing nothing? Why would we fight through the traffic, fight through the cold, to sit there to watch half of a basketball game? The other half being blocked by people coming in and out. Why would we get in the car and drive all the way back to Austin, stopping off at Whataburger to get our free sandwiches, on the back of those tickets, free Whataburger? Hey, when you get a present from God, you use the whole present. And we waited for 25 minutes in Whataburger to get our sandwiches. By this time, Ben was so tired, he curled up in the back seat, and I drove the rest of the way back by myself, pulled in the driveway at 12:30 a.m., and I'm thinking, why do this? During the basketball game, as I sat there with my son, the reason why I do this all dawned on me. Because here is this 8-year-old boy that has a smile on his face, and he's got a smile on his face because he's doing something that he loves to do with his dad. And the smile on his face is not just because we're at a basketball game, not just because Tim Duncan is dunking all over the place. The smile on his face is because he and Dad are together, and they're enjoying this time together. And while I was sitting there thinking about that, I realized I just learned something about worship. Because God is the same way. As much as I take delight in putting a smile on my son's face, that he delights in me, God in the same way loves for us to smile at him and delight in him. God loves for us to love him. And in our love for him, he gains incredible satisfaction and incredible joy. Henry Scogill said these words, "The worth and excellency of a soul is to be measured by the object of its love." Now think about that. The worth and the excellency of a soul is to be measured by the object of its love. Can we test that theory? Let's try. Take a soul that loves violence and war. There are people that do. Would you say that the worth of that soul is excellent? Would you say that that soul is a noble soul? Would you say that soul is a significant or valuable soul? Let's compare that soul to a person who loves stuff. Their life is about acquiring stuff. Shiny things, things that glitter, things that last a little while, things that last a long time. The stuff of this earth. And that's their love. They love that. And they spend their life gathering it. Now, what would we say about a soul that loves the acquisition of stuff? Would we say that it is an excellent soul? A noble soul? Well, let's compare that soul to someone who loves children. Take a person who loves children, who loves to teach children, who loves to help children laugh, who loves to help children learn, who takes care of children, and loves kids. What's the worth, the value, the excellency of that soul? It seems to reason that the more important the object of our love, the better the object of our love, the more noble, the more excellent, the more worthy our soul. So would it also stand to reason that if God is the greatest thing, the most worthy thing, the noblest thing, the most beautiful thing in all of the universe, that the soul that loves God is supreme, the soul that loves God, that is focused on God, that that particular soul is a worthwhile, noble, worthy soul? How about you? Do you love God? Would your life demonstrate a worth based on loving God and following Him with all of your heart? You say, "Tim, you know, I'd like to be able to say that that's true about me, but the reality is that I get stuck in this world. I mean, I'm down here and I'm looking at all my circumstances and all the stuff that's going on around me, and to think about God just seems like, you know, I got to get into another dimension because I don't live in that dimension and I forget about Him." Well, if you forget about Him, join the club. That has been the plight of mankind down throughout history. And it's because of that that this sermon series that I've been preaching the last 8 weeks on the goodness of God, that sermon series was born. Because I want us to look at our God. And when we look at our God and we see our God and we see Him through the hearts and perspectives of the people who've known Him most closely, we gain a renewed understanding of the greatness of our God and the opportunity to worship Him. One of those experiences took place in Isaiah chapter 40 when it wasn't actually someone speaking about God, it was actually God speaking about Himself. And He told the prophet Isaiah to record these words about Himself. The context of Isaiah 40 is a context of depression because you see, the nation of Israel was in captivity. Their world had crumbled. They were in the middle of the Babylonian Empire, and they were beginning to ask the question, will we ever go home? Will our way of life, will our national heritage, will our national worship, will our people, will our homeland, will that ever be restored? What's wrong with God? He obviously has lost control. And in the midst of that, God says, hey, look at me. Take a look at me when you see your God. you're going to change your perspective. As we look at Isaiah chapter 40, we see starting in verse 12 that God asks 12 rhetorical questions in order to get people to think about who He is. And in order to get people to think about who He is, He asks questions about things that we have trouble understanding. Notice what He says in verse 12. He says, "Who has measured the waters in the hollow of His hand? Or with the breadth of His hand marked off the heavens?" He's asking a question about creation. He says, when you think about creation, who put all of this stuff there? Where did it come from? Because if you understand the magnitude of the one who created everything, you're going to understand a little bit about God. And you're going to understand that God is all powerful. So the question is, if God measured the waters of the earth in the palm of His hand, how big is God's hand? How big is God's hand? Well, it's pretty easy to figure out. Just take the volume of the water on the earth. The water on the earth makes up 71% of the earth's surface. And I am told, last service we had an engineer from Texas A&M University who told us that this 1.2 with all those zeros is 1.2 quintillion. 1.2 quintillion. Now, if that's not right, you probably went to the University of Texas, okay? It was Noel Scoggins, and he did get out his slide rule, and he measured it and put his slide rule back in. Say, that's a pretty big hand. If God could measure the earth in His hand, measure the waters in His hand, we're talking about an incredibly powerful, enormous, very strong God. God is something above and beyond everything that we've ever imagined. It says that He laid out the heavens by using His hand as a measurement. From the tip of His thumb to the end of His little finger, He spanned the heavens and figured out exactly how He would lay out the stars of the sky. It says in verse 13, the last half of verse 12, "Who has held the dust of the earth in a basket? Or weighed the mountains on the scales and the hills in a balance?" Well, how big is God's basket? God's basket is as big as the weight of the earth. God's basket is 6 sextillion tons. That's a pretty big basket. If God can measure the waters in His hand, if He carries the material to make the earth in His basket, we're talking about a very powerful, powerful being. In addition to that, do you know that every square yard of the sun is constantly emitting 130,000 horsepower, the equivalent of 450 eight-cylinder automobiles. Every square yard of the sun is kicking out 130,000 horsepower of energy. Now, if I were to take a dime from my pocket and hold it in my hand and extend it at arm's length at the night sky, that little dot made by that dime in my view, that little dot in the night sky, represents 15 million stars. I would be blocking 15 million stars from my view by one little dime. You say, who made all this? God did. All we have to do is look around us, and we see that God is very strong. Not only is God the strongest, but He's also the smartest. Verse 13 says, "Who has understood the mind of the Lord? Or who instructed Him as His counselor?" Where did God get His education? Who taught Him? Where did He get His degrees? Verse 14, "To whom did the Lord consult to enlighten Him? Who taught Him the right way?" What consulting engineer did God consult with on the creation of the earth? Who taught Him the way of right? What Supreme Court justice educated Him in ethics? What clergyman or council of bishops taught Him the way of righteousness? Who wrote the Ten Commandments and gave it to God to tutor Him? Answer, nobody. He came up with all of this on His own. He goes on to say, "Who was it that taught Him knowledge or showed Him the path of understanding?" Where did God get all the intelligence to put all this together? The answer, He got it from Himself. God is the smartest. Carl Sagan a few years ago wrote a book called The Dragons of Eden. And in this book, he tells this example. He says, a single human chromosome contains 20 billion bits of information. How much information is 20 billion bits? That would be, what would it be equivalent if it were written down in an ordinary printed book in modern human language? 20 billion bits are the equivalent of about 3 billion letters. If there are approximately 6 letters in an average word, the information content of a human chromosome corresponds to about 500 million words. If there were about 300 words on an ordinary printed page, this corresponds to about 2 million pages. If the typical book contains 500 such pages, the information content of a single human chromosome corresponds to some 4,000 volumes of information. It is clear then that the chromosomes contain an enormous library of information. It is equally clear that so rich a library is required to specify as exquisitely constructed and intricately functioning an object as a human being. Now, when Carl Sagan penned those words, I'm not confident that he knew who this was that created the intelligence to come up with a human chromosome. I'm confident that today he does. I'm absolutely confident that today he knows exactly who did all this. Who in the world could possibly postulate that the intricacies of one human chromosome, not to mention the other mammals and the other reptiles and the other fish and the birds of the air and the bugs on the ground and the grass and the trees and all that's created, all of the information and the variation of all that information did not come from someone intelligent and not just any old average PhD, God Himself. We're talking about incredible smarts. That is our God. Now, in comparison to God, how do we measure? How do we rate in comparison to God? Notice verse 15. Surely the nations are like a drop in a bucket. They are regarded as dust on the scales. He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. You see, in relationship to God, we are small. We are small in our weight. He says, hey, we're like a drop in a bucket. We're like dust on the scales. Now, I'm sure that all of you very good, smart shoppers, when you go shopping for groceries and you come up there with all of your produce, the first thing you do when the checker starts to weigh your produce is you reach over there with your sleeve and you dust off the scale, right? Because it would be unfortunate to pay for that dust. You know, she measures the weight, that dust is going to add something, right? Or for those of you who aren't quite that picky, you probably take your bag, you know, that the salary comes in, and you probably say, now take the salary out of the bag and weigh it because I don't want to have to pay for this bag. You say, that's absolutely ludicrous. The bag doesn't weigh anything. The dust doesn't weigh anything. Get the point? God is saying, in relationship to me, the nations are like a drop in the bucket. They're like dust on the scale. Now, who are the nations? Like the great United States of America? Like the former Soviet Union? Like Great Britain? Like the Spanish in the Middle Ages? And their powerful, powerful empire? How about the Portuguese? You see, throughout all of history, mankind's felt pretty good about their powerful nations. But where's Napoleon today? We're Charlemagne in the Holy Roman Empire. How about Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar? Where is Adolf Hitler? Where is Idi Amin? Where will Saddam Hussein be? Pretty bad shape if he keeps this up, right? The world, which is made up of people and nations that feel so significant, are really small in comparison to God. Not only is man small in his weight, but he's also small in his worship. Verse 16 says, Lebanon is not sufficient for altar fires, nor its animals enough for burnt offerings. If you were to take all the trees in Lebanon, all the cedars, cut them all down, pull them together in a bonfire, what would that look like? You know, I thought about that for a while. What would that look like? Would it look something like this? Yeah. 125,000 man hours each year go into constructing the Aggie Bonfire. And folks, the Aggie Bonfire is small compared to what it would take if you took all the trees in Lebanon, brought them all together, sacrificed all of the animals on it. You say that would be a colossal fire. It would make the Aggie Bonfire look like a bonfire. God says, hey, you guys, I'd roast my marshmallows on that fire. That is small compared to what it would take to truly honor me with a sacrifice, with an offering. Man is small in his worship. And finally, in verse 17, man is small in his worth. Before him, before God, all the nations are as nothing. They are regarded by him as worthless and less than nothing. When compared to God, the nations of the world, in their worth, the people of the world are small in comparison. Was 1997 an important year in the history of the world? For us, it was a very important history because we're living in 1997. You notice just about every year in all of the reports and all of the media and all the places, we view each year of our lives as this is going to be a pivotal year in human history. I love the way how George Will summed up the year 1997 in its pivotal nature. Speaking of the economy, he said, so prodigiously did the economic growth rate generate revenues for the government, the political class could hardly avoid balancing the budget. But it did avoid it. While preening about producing, well, promising for the year 2002, the first balanced budget since 1969, the political class proved itself more united by class interests than divided by ideology, and it generated a geyser of domestic spending increases that prevented the economy from balancing the budget right now. In other words, if they had just left it alone, the budget would have been balanced this year. But they put all these spending increases, because this is a pivotal year. We need to spend the money while we don't have it. It's important. How about 70 people who fled the country or took the Fifth Amendment to avoid talking about the president's innovative campaign finance practices, which he said were beyond reproach and, he said, proof that reforms are urgently needed? Now think about that for a minute. 70 people either took the Fifth Amendment or fled the country to avoid talking about this innovative campaign financing, which is beyond reproach and in great reason why we need reforms. Doesn't make sense, but that's how we thought in 1997. Ted Turner promised $1 billion to the United Nations, and the movie Titanic cost more than the president's 1996 campaign. The world was made safe from landmines and chemical weapons. It says so on pieces of paper. Perhaps Saddam Hussein, who demonstrated that the UN inspectors are in Iraq at his sufferance, has not read those pieces of paper. In Iowa, a fertility specialist counted to seven and declared the treatment of Mrs. McCaughey had achieved an unexpected degree of success. In Boca Raton, Florida, an umpire asked if the 12-year-old catcher was wearing a protective cup. I'm a girl, said Melissa Raglan. That's no excuse. Rules are rules, said some baseball bureaucrats. The president of the local chapter of the National Organization for Women sniffled harassment. And all the while, a friend of Timothy McVeigh's testified, if you don't consider what happened in Oklahoma City, Tim is a good person. A gadget named Sojourner gave the world a close-up glimpse of Mars in the nick of time, given evidence from the Hubble telescope suggesting that a galaxy racing toward our galaxy at 300,000 miles an hour may produce an obliterating collision in just 5 billion years. Aren't you glad we found out what's on Mars before that happened? Well, 39 adherents of Heaven's Gate decided not to wait for that collision. They checked out early. A sheep named Dolly was a marvel, and so was a golfer named Tiger. And that was the year 1997 in these United States. You say, man, that's a lot of noise, but not a lot of substance. And you're right. And every generation produces a lot of noise, but not a lot of substance, because substance is only found in one place. substances found in God. And in comparison to God, we are small. Also, in comparison to God, we worship silly things. Notice verse 18. He says, to whom then will you compare God? What image will you compare him to? As for an idol, a craftsman casts it, and a goldsmith overlays it with gold, and fashions silver chains for it. A man too poor to present such an offering selects wood that will not rot, and he looks for a skilled craftsman to set up an idol that will not topple. Here God is telling us some good advice. You know, the two things required in coming up with a God, if you're going to make your own God, you know, kind of get your do-it-yourself God kit, the two things that are required, first of all, is that it look good. That's why you select a craftsman to overlay it with gold. That's very important, because if you have a God that's ugly, or a God that's not as pretty as your furniture, your dining room furniture, or not as good as your tea and coffee sets, that wouldn't work very well. But if you don't have the money for a gold God, he goes on to say in verse 20, you select wood that will not rot. You at least get a kind of wood that will last a little longer, because if termites get in your God, man, that would be really bad. Now, the second most important criterion when creating a God is to make sure that you create one that will not tip over. In verse 19, it says that you put silver chains on it to keep it upright. And in verse 20, you want to make the base of the wooden one big enough so it won't tip over. Can you imagine the horror when you're kneeling for prayer before your God and a breeze comes through the window and your God tips over? Like, now that would be hard to worship a God that couldn't stand on his own two feet, wouldn't it? You say, God is mocking us. You're right. These verses, God is making fools out of us. He's mocking our worship. You say, well, none of us would go out and create a God. Well, is that true? We create a computer, and we give it our time, and we give it all of our creativity, and we give it our money, and we give it our love and our affection. Is that a God? We buy a new automobile, and we wash it and wax it and wash it and wax it and shine it and drive it with pride, and we feel differently because we're experiencing the ride. We go out and create a set of golf clubs, and you know, we practice our chipping and practice our chipping and practice our chipping and practice our chipping, because one of these days we want to be able to chip. Is there anything wrong with having a car? Is there anything wrong with having a computer? Is there anything wrong with having... Not at all, but the question is, where is your heart? If you love stuff, if you live for stuff, if there are certain things, certain passions of your life that take precedent over your relationship with God, you've created an idol. And the question is, does it look good enough to keep your attention forever? Does the shine and the sheen look good enough? Is it stable enough that it won't tip over, that it'll give you stability? You say, that's absolutely silly. That's what God is saying. We as humans tend to worship silly things. Not only that, we tend to worship silly people. Notice what God says in verse 20, or verse 21. He says, do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood since the earth was founded that he sits enthroned above the circle of the earth, and his people are like grasshoppers? He stretches out the heavens like a canopy and spreads them out like a tent to live in. He brings princes to naught and reduces the rulers of this world to nothing. No sooner are they planted, no sooner are they sown, no sooner do they take root in the ground than he blows on them and they wither, and the whirlwind sweeps them away like chaff. We have a tendency to worship stuff. We have a tendency also to worship people and to look up to people and to think that we're going to find our security in people or our significance in people. We were at that San Antonio Spurs basketball game, and they brought out four San Antonio Spurs that had played in the past that were now living in the San Antonio area to honor them. I did not know the names of any of those guys. They're nobodies as far as I'm concerned, and you know what? My son doesn't know the names of anybody that I thought were important. When I watched basketball, my idols are gone. His idols are new people. The most popular woman on the face of the earth lost her life in 1997 in a car crash in a tunnel in Paris. And when she lost her life, the world outpour for her, the crying, the weeping, the wailing for her, the outpour of love and affection was overwhelming. It was amazing. But she was only here for a short time, and then she was gone. And I wonder, when she stands in the presence of God, does she bring out a title to impress God? Does she say to God, Princess of Wales, does that do anything for me? Does that help out here? The money that I receive for my position, I've given some of it to charity. Does that help out here? Because the moment she stood in the presence of God, she was either prepared to spend a life in heaven with the Heavenly Father, or she got a one-way ticket to eternal damnation. And that's one of the only two places. That's her only two options. I have no idea which one's true. Just a moment and just a breath, the celebrities of the world pass off the scene. Do we worship people? If we do, we worship silly things. Finally, God calls us in verse 25 to take a close look at Him. He says, to whom will you compare me? Or who is my equal, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings the starry host one by one and calls them each by name. Because of His great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing. He says, look, lift up your eyes and look at me. And if you can't see me, look at the sky. As you look across the sky, you see every one of those millions and millions and millions of stars. I'm the one who put them there. I placed them all there. I bring them out every night. I dot the sky with them. I call them by name. If you can't see my face, look at what I've created. He says, when you look at me, you're going to see the supreme object of worship. And my question to you is, in 1997, were your eyes focused on God? Was your face smiling in the presence of God? Did you delight your heart in Him? Were you looking to Him? As we close 1997, I want us to stop and worship our God and look into the face of our God.
You are beautiful beyond description, too marvelous for words, too wonderful for comprehension, like nothing ever seen or heard. Who can grasp your infinite wisdom? Who can fathom the depth of your love? You are beautiful beyond description, majesty enthroned above. And I stand in awe of you. I stand in awe of you. Holy God, to whom all praise is due,
wonderful, more comprehensive.
Say, boy, I'd love to live a life that was focused on God. But I got to be honest with you. I'm stuck here on earth and I just get my eyes on my own circumstances. And when I do that, I tend to forget who He is and how important He is and how significant He is and what He's trying to do in my life. If that's what you're feeling today, join the crowd. You're not unique. That's the way the world functions and that's the way we live. And it was certainly not new to the nation of Israel. Because the nation of Israel in verse 27 was asking the question of God. Why do you say, O Jacob, and complain, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord. My cause is disregarded by my God. God, you're not paying attention to me. Don't you realize that my world is not going the way it ought to go? God, how come you're not paying attention to me? They're complaining. And whenever we complain against God, that is tantamount to diminishing Him. To saying, God, you've lost control, or you're not paying attention, or you're not focused on the right things. To which God responds in verse 28, Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He's the everlasting God from beginning to end, from the beginning of creation to the end of creation, all sides of the globe. He will not grow tired or weary, and His understanding no one can fathom. If you don't understand what's going on, don't panic, because you're not going to understand God. You're not going to understand all of His ways. You're not going to understand all of His timing. But you can be assured of this. He says, your way is not hidden from the Lord. God's not oblivious to you. He hasn't gotten tired of paying attention. God doesn't check out. He doesn't go on vacation. He doesn't have a holiday. He doesn't have a brain lapse. There's never a time in human history when God is not present, when God is checked out, and He never gets tired of paying attention. And He never gets tired of paying attention to you. You think, you know, God's thinking, oh, how many billion people do I have to keep up with now? God never feels that way. And whenever you say, God, I'm looking at my circumstances and I'm wondering where you are. What are you doing, God? Whenever you complain against God, what you're doing is you're diminishing your view of God. The proper response He gives here in verse 29, He says He gives strength to the weary and He increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. He says, you're going to get tired. Everybody does. Even young people get tired. Even youths grow tired and weary. You're going to get worn out in this life. Things are not going to go your way. You're going to get beat down. You're going to run out of energy. My three-year-old can go and go and go and go at such a pace that I wonder sometimes, how in the world can anybody move that many muscles at the same time and keep doing it? And sometimes I think it's going to go on indefinitely, but you know what? Even he crashes. Everybody gets tired, everybody gets weary, everybody gets down, everybody gets worn out. And God says, I am the source of your strength. If you want to be invigorated for life, you come to me, and I'll invigorate you. I will give you life. He says, those who hope in the Lord, verse 34, will renew their strength. What does it mean to hope in the Lord? Well, it doesn't mean to take control of your life. What it means is to trust that God is in control and look for what He's going to do next in your world, no matter how dark the circumstances. To pray and to seek God and to look for Him and to let Him do what He's going to do with full confidence that He's a good God. He says, if you will do that, you will soar on wings like eagles. You will run and not grow weary. You will walk and not be faint. Why does he say those three things? Why those three metaphors in the text? I'm not exactly sure, but I think it's this. I think he's saying there are times when you're going to be flying high. In your position in life, you're going to be soaring over this world. And God's going to give you the strength to do that. There are going to be other times when you're on an endurance race and you're running hard. And God can give you the strength to do that. And there are going to be times in your life when things are slow and you're going at a slow pace. And God can give you the strength to walk through those times. Whether you need to fly, whether you need to run, whether you need to walk, the source of strength is God. And it's not just saying, God, help me. It's hoping in God. It's looking to God. It's placing your life in His hands. It's saying, you lead me, God. You guide me. You help me along the way. And it's keeping that gaze, that focus, that look at God. It's being tuned into Him and paying attention to Him. In order to help you this year, one of the goals that we've established for Hill Country Bible Church in 1998 is that every person in the church would read through the Bible during the coming year. You say, man, that's a lot of reading. That's a lot of reading. I don't know that I can do that. Well, the plan that we're going to prepare and give to you is if you read between 3 and 4 chapters a day on an average chapter. Now, when you're in the Psalms and some of them are 3 verses or 4 verses long, you may read more than that. If you'll read 10 to 15 minutes a day, each day during the course of the year, you will read through the entire Bible in 1 year. There are a lot of people that have been in the faith for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years that have never read through the whole Bible. If you want to see your God and you want to know your God, we want you to read His Word. And we're going to give you a plan to do that. In fact, as you leave this morning, we're going to give you a bookmark for the month of January that has the days in January and the passages to read. If you get behind one day, you can easily catch up. We're giving you this before the year so you can start, because Thursday is the first day. Don't wait till Sunday or you'll be 4 days behind. And the goal is not just to read it to check off these check marks. The goal is to look for your God each and every day in the pages of His Word. And He will reveal Himself to you as you read His Word, and your life will be changed as you focus on Him. Our God is a good God, and our spirits are the noblest. Our souls are the most worthy when our love is focused on worshiping Him. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Father in heaven, You are a great God. Amidst all the beauty of Your creation, forgive us for seeing the problems of life and doubting You. Our desire is to love You with all of our hearts. Help us to get excited, enthusiastic, to have the energy to read through Your Word this year. And that not only next year would we be smarter when it comes to knowing You, but we would be deeper and truer, purer in our hearts. Father, You're a great God, and we love You today, and we worship You in Jesus' name. Amen.